Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 17th, 2006. Today's session is entitled Emerging International Standards of Corporate Responsibility, presented by Steve Balls. The number is BAH-S-2006-03. Let's listen in.
Well, I want to thank you all for joining us on this beautiful afternoon. This is a great opportunity for me. I've not been to Holden Village before. This is my first week at Holden. My wife and I and my daughter arrived at Holden on Wednesday of last week, and it's just been a wonderful time of hiking, going to sessions like this, getting to know very interesting people. 5 years ago, I'd never heard of Holden Village, and I'm just so delighted to be here. I spend the academic year serving at Augustana College, where I serve as its president. Prior to that, though, I was a practicing lawyer and a law school dean and a law professor. One of my early passions that I developed from the practice of law in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, a few of you have heard this story, was a corporate responsibility and interest in corporate responsibility. I was involved in the Greater Milwaukee Council of Churches. We were looking at various social issues in the Milwaukee area, and because I was an attorney, one of the issues that came to my desk through the Greater Milwaukee Council of Churches was an incident in West Allis, Wisconsin. West Allis is a mature suburb of Milwaukee. West Allis at the time in the 80s was almost a one-horse town. Allis Chalmers Manufacturing Company was there. Do you remember what Allis Chalmers made? Tractors, a pretty good tractor. They were experiencing significant economic problems in the 80s and were thinking about closing the West Allis plant. Somehow a confidential memo from management of Allis Chalmers made its way into a pastor's office, and the Milwaukee County Attorney was going to prosecute the pastor for having this confidential memo which said they were thinking about closing the West Allis operations and kind of detailing a plan to do that. Well, the pastor, we made a lot of noise, and the prosecutor dropped the threat to prosecute. The pastor didn't know that this was a confidential document. Someone slid it under his door. The person that didn't, we never identified. That did it, we never identified. Probably a parishioner. May not have known that it was a confidential document. Nonetheless, we decided to take this negative and turn it into a positive. We decided to submit a shareholders resolution on behalf of that church. That was a Presbyterian church. The endowment fund from that church had some Allis Chalmers stocks. So we submitted a shareholders resolution to Allis Chalmers management saying that we believe that the corporation should adopt a stance that will give 6 months' notice before they close any plant. And during that 6 months, they will engage in a dialogue with the community about cushioning the blow of the plant closure, not requiring them to do anything specific, just to talk about it and give 6 months' notice. You should have seen the letter that I got back from Allis Chalmers. You would think that the roof had caved in. 101 reasons almost why this was an illegal resolution, why they weren't going to do it, and so on and so forth. But in the end, we persuaded them that we thought we could force the Securities Exchange Commission to get it on the proxy statement and before the shareholders. To our surprise, they invited us to New York. We negotiated with the company in New York and got an agreement to give 90 days notice of any plant closure, and that would be a company-wide policy to give the employees an opportunity. So I've been interested in corporate responsibility since then, interested in how individuals and churches and others can, a little bit like David and Goliath, take on a large corporation and make a real difference. Now, was that an earth-shaking difference? No. But it was a significant difference. The plant closed. The employees got 90 days notice. Allis Chalmers entered into negotiations with the community. The old plant became a business incubator for the community. So some good things happened out of it. Well, what I'd like to do in talking today and visiting with you today, and I'd like this to be participatory, is to think about best practices internationally with respect to corporate responsibility. like to talk about some emerging corporate and international standards for corporations and ask how we can encourage corporations to adopt these emerging international standards. Next time, tomorrow, we will talk about what I call the plantation labor problem, what many academics call the plantation labor problem. That is when corporations go into third world countries, because of lower wages, perhaps laxer environmental regulation, a laxer regulatory scheme, and there is effectively very little regulation of corporate conduct. What are the obligations of United States corporations when you don't have the government telling them what to do? In the United States, the government does a lot of telling what to do about social responsibility. That is not apparent in other countries. On Wednesday, we'll talk about, if we are a multinational corporation, drafting our own code of ethics and a code of ethics that might work, and we'll take a look at those corporate codes that do work and ask why. And then on Thursday, the last session on corporate responsibility, we'll take a look at these shareholders resolutions, specifically those offered by the ELCA, by virtue of their ownership of stock that attempt to encourage corporations to act responsibly. That is where we are headed over the next few days. I think this is an important time for us to start thinking about corporate responsibility internationally, because, in fact, as you all know, we are seeing, I think, a dramatic shift in our economy. Would you, a world economy, would you agree? And this is a time where there is a substantial opportunity, in my mind, to develop some world standards for corporate responsibility that might be different than United States standards for corporate responsibility. To tee up the conversation, many have observed that United States corporate law does not travel well. That is, United States corporate law is very different in many ways from the corporate law throughout the rest of the world, and people from the rest of the world looking at United States corporate law and our patterns of doing business don't always understand it. They don't understand CEO compensation. I've taught about corporate responsibility in Europe. There's just not an understanding of how CEOs can be paid so many times what rank and file workers are being paid. It is something that is almost foreign to the cultures abroad. But interestingly, within the last 10 years, Japan and Germany, which had previously outlawed stock options as a form of compensation, switch their positions to be globally competitive. So in those countries, nations of Japan and Germany, businesses incorporated there can have stock options. We're seeing some of the United States law being exported elsewhere. In Europe, there's a very different view of employment. There is greater employment security in Germany until recently, and still with many corporations, there is much greater employee and labor union input on the board. Ownership of many European and Japanese corporations tends to be much more concentrated, with shareholders, banks, wealthy families monitoring the conduct of the corporation much more successfully. So United States corporate law does not travel well. In the United States, what is the object of a business corporation? Object of a business corporation is to return a profit to shareholders. In Europe, is that the object of a business corporation? Well, no. If you look at the corporate codes in Europe and elsewhere, that is an important object, but not the sole object. In Germany, the corporate law says that the object of a business corporation is to improve the commonwealth and the welfare of society. Now, they do that in many ways, primarily through running a profitable business. Well, what I'd like to do is take a look at... yes?
How many? So in America, how many kinds of corporations are there?
How many socially responsible corporations are there?
How many kinds of corporations?
Oh, I thought you said Heinz. How many kinds of corporations? Well, elaborate a little bit on that.
Well, there's eleemosynary corporations, and there's municipal corporations.
Yes, and I'm here primarily talking about business corporations, but there are many types of corporations here, municipal corporations. Many states provide for religious corporations separately from general charitable corporations, business trust partnerships, limited liability companies. We talked a little bit last week about Henry Ford in the case of Ford Motor Company when we looked at the object of a business corporation. In 1919, the Dodge brothers, now you associate the Dodge brothers, don't you, with Chrysler these days, but in 1919, they were minority shareholders. They owned less than half the stock in Ford Motor Company. Henry Ford said, this company is making too much money. Henry Ford said there's something wrong with Ford Motor Company when workers can't afford the automobiles that this manufacturer produces. The Dodge brothers sued Henry Ford. He said, this is not a charitable, corporation. You're very idealistic. Now, his idealism, in fact, may have been to kind of squeeze the Dodge brothers out of starting a competing a corporation. But in 1919, in the seminal case about corporate responsibility, the Michigan Supreme Court said the object of a business corporation is to return a profit to the shareholders. It is not a charitable organization. Instead, it ordered a dividend to the Dodge brothers and all shareholders. That has set the base. Well, let's then move from. Before we talk about evolving corporate codes, let me ask you: do you think that absent intervention, that there is economic incentive for corporations to act in a responsible way if that responsible way does not enhance the bottom line?
Can you repeat that one more time?
Yeah. Are there sufficient economic... If we let the market rule, if we let Adam Smith's invisible hand work, will corporations be responsible if that responsibility interferes with profitability?
No.
Sure. How so?
The corporation exists to maximize what the shareholders want.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have to be profits.
Okay. Let's talk about publicly held corporations.
I'm a stockholder in REI.
Okay.
And I don't think they're trying to maximize the bottom line.
Yeah, I would say that REI is a little different type of corporation. It's a co-op. Not a business corporation.
Yeah.
Some attributes of a business corporation. Let me ask the question this way. Is there substantial incentive for corporations to exceed pollution regulations? That is, not only to control pollution to the extent required by law, but control pollution much more than required by law. Cut emissions by half of what is required by law. Yes.
I think there's a fork in the road that companies can take. Now, there are some companies that can race to the bottom, and there are other companies that, as part of their marketing strategy and their general persona, can and do actually go the other direction.
Okay.
I guess that's why I didn't answer that to the first question you asked, which is you said if that's harmful to the bottom line. But I think there are some corporations who do it because they think it actually will enhance their...
Yes, yes. I think that's right. I don't think that always works. I often hear, however, that sustainability, for example, for a corporation to show that its production method is sustainable for the next 100 years, always adds to the bottom line. I'm not sure about that. I'm not sure that there are market incentives there for corporations to pursue sustainability on a short-term basis. Now, if you have a group of shareholders that are particularly homogeneous, that are concerned about the environment, perhaps. But in widely held corporations, I'm not sure that's the case. Suppose that a corporation says, we are going to be management, socially responsible. We, in fact, are going to cut our pollution emissions by half. We used to pay the minimum wage, but we're going to pay everyone now a living wage. In fact, even more so than a living wage. we are going to be responsible as a corporation. We're going to be so responsible that we're willing to cut emissions, pay living wages, but our profitability, we recognize, will decrease by 50%. What happens to a corporation that does that, do you think? Well, why would they get a new executive very quickly?
Shareholders won't make as much money.
Shareholders won't make as much money. What's the market mechanism, though, that's going to make that happen?
Takeover,
probably. So to the extent that corporate profitability is cut, stock prices will tend to trend downward, making that company a takeover candidate. And what is the corporate raider going to do? Fire management in the first case. So the market incentives may be there, but market incentives certainly don't get us all the way to a responsibility. Let's look at government incentives on the other side. Now, we rely upon government to encourage corporations to be successful. Does that work? And let's talk about third world countries. The government officials have incentives to encourage corporate responsibility in third world countries.
Third world governments.
You mean, do our executives have incentives?
No, third world governments. So in Thailand, are there in Vietnam? Those may be bad examples. In developing countries.
Vietnam's turning out okay.
What's that?
Vietnam's turning out okay.
Yeah.
Thailand's
having
lots of problems.
Yeah. Yeah.
But those officials have incentives to ignore the regulations.
What are those incentives?
Cash under the table.
Yeah.
Bribes. It's illegal. Happens nonetheless. Yeah. Illegal for U.S. corporations to pay bribes to foreign officials, though there are many exceptions to those rules. Well, what if a third world country wants to raise the prevailing wage rate, has been lax on pollution control. How is a multinational corporation going to respond?
Go somewhere else.
So the incentives are not necessarily there for third world governments, developing countries, necessarily governments to act in a way that encourages a responsibility. So how do we do it? What are the evolving international standards, and how can we ask corporations and encourage corporations to voluntarily act in a socially responsible way? I've included in the materials. Do you all have copies of the materials? Are there extras floating around? There are a host of international codes promulgated by various groups about what corporate responsibility might be. In unit number 2 of the materials, I've summarized some of those codes. One is the UN Global Compact, which sets out 9 principles for corporate responsibility. The others are the Global Sullivan Principles of Human Rights over on the next page. Take a look at these principles, basic principles for responsible conduct of business, basic support and protection of human rights, labor standards. Primarily, we see in labor standards respect labor unions, no forced or compulsory labor, no child labor. Environment, some general standards there, using precautionary approaches to environmental challenges, a greater environmental responsibility, and anti-corruption to work against bribery. These tend to be typical of the categories that we see on global codes. There's another global code also put out by the United Nations. That's the Code of Conduct for Transnational Corporations. That Code of Conduct for Transnational Corporations, which is not in your materials, includes a couple of other items. It's a stricter code for corporations. Sensitivity to the cultural values of host nations. respect for the sovereignty of host nations. Who do you think sponsored the, which countries do you think might sponsor the code for conduct for transnational corporations that the United Nations has adopted? Now, these are voluntary codes. I think it was the United States that sponsored it. No, this code, which I think is the most rigorous, was sponsored by Netherlands. I guess we can understand that. We think of that as a trading center. But also sponsored, and the lead sponsor was the Islamic Republic of Iran. Isn't that interesting? So we can learn some things from other countries. You see, I think, the fingerprint of the government of Iran, respect for respect for a nation's sovereignty, for example, a respect for the cultural values of the nation. Yes.
But is that just a way of making war?
Making war?
Right.
Well, how so?
Well, it would seem to me Iran isn't noted for being a peace-loving, a people-loving nation. So if they can put pressures on America through this medium.
No, that's not the way that I see it with respect to Iran. I mean, I think there is one of the reasons that U.S. Law concerning corporate responsibility doesn't travel well is that it conflicts with the culture of many countries. And certainly U.S. Trade customs and U.S. business may well conflict with the culture of many Islamic countries. The emphasis on materialism, the emphasis on homogeneity, the emphasis on consumption. So that is my reading, that is kind of their contribution to it. What do you make of this UN Global Compact? It is voluntary, certainly, for corporations to sign on to it. Do you think it's effective? Is this a step forward?
I think it's definitely a step forward to get everyone thinking about it. As far as them adhering to it, that's another whole other thing. But to have it out in the open, have it publicized that this could be going on and suggested, I think it's a good factor.
Sure.
Making corporates more responsible or feel responsible without incentives. Why do they have to have incentives to do the right thing? That just baffles me.
Mm-hmm. Any other thoughts? Let's move over to the Sullivan, the global Sullivan principles. You're familiar with the Sullivan principles, many of you. The global Sullivan principles have been subscribed to by many of the largest firms in the United States for how they will do business worldwide. The global Sullivan principles are just a little broader than the principles that we see in the United States, or in the United Nations compact. But you see some of the same regulatory framework there, respect for human rights, no discrimination, respect for employees, voluntary freedom of association, labor, and trade unions. Sullivan principles in the fourth bullet point are a little more specific in terms of what ought to be expected. Compensate employees to enable them to meet the most basic needs and provide an opportunity to improve skills. Provide a safe and healthy workplace. Work with governments in determining ways in which we can improve the quality of life, not only quality of life on the factory floor, but educational, cultural, economic, and social well-being. Look at that last bullet point. Promote the application of these principles by those whom with we do business. You think the Sullivan principles make any difference?
You mean, would they if they were...
Well, a lot of companies have subscribed to them. Yeah. You think they make a difference within those companies?
One would think, and if they were actually paying employees a living wage, that would certainly make a difference for the employees. But whether... I don't know whether it would be profitable, but whether the company is going to be able to do well and avoid takeover and that kind of stuff, but they pay a living wage.
Well, why would companies agree to this? So does this add to profitability?
There's always the fear that some honest reporter will begin to report, or even worse, make comparisons that says, this company has had these transgressions and this company has not.
Okay. So voluntary codes such as these in some ways can be a response to head off at the pass negative publicity. Yes. Yes, sir, and then we'll just move down the line.
Okay. I'm wondering if this could evolve in an analogous way to the ISO standards, where whereby it becomes a requirement in the competition and a way of at least some companies or governments controlling a more level playing field. And if that's the case, then certainly this would have an effect. Because it's a market driver.
You know, that is an excellent point. We're going to talk about that a little bit as we conclude our hour together. How do you take these codes and evolving international standards and put teeth into them? That is, have something more than simply a website. You ought to go on the Sullivan Principles website. It's an interesting website. It has the companies that have subscribed, talks a little bit about the history of this, but... how do you make it really make a difference? And you point out one area. Yes?
I suspect that companies are also trying to forestall their regulation by putting forth some kind of voluntary. That's.
Yeah, I think that's right.
But some of these companies, you can go to many countries in the world and implement all these things and still pay wages which were well below what you'd pay in Decorah, Iowa. Right?
Indeed.
And you could dramatically improve the standard of living of the workers that you were dealing with and encourage them through positive incentives to acquire education and training and to promote infrastructure development and all that sort of thing. Now, whether that's going to happen in every case isn't clear. But it certainly is not beyond the pale to think that a company could, in fact, go into a place where human capital is very cheap and there's lots of potential. Adhere to these standards and develop labor resources, human resources, at a much better fraction of the cost, where they can do some of this stuff.
And in fact, groups, we'll talk a little bit more about this later in the week, that monitor compliance by corporations. Corporations that subject themselves to voluntary monitoring, many of them, in fact, do that. That is, comply with these standards and make a profit. And pay wages substantially lower than in the United States, but wages which are living wages.
Substantially higher than
substantially higher than the prevailing wage. Jeannie?
Yes. I was just going to say that I'm a real practical person, but I believe that when employees feel like they're listened to and cared about, I would think they'd be more productive because they aren't going to spend so much energy being angry or trying to rip off their employer or whatever. So I would think happier employees would be more productive. But maybe that's hopeful thinking.
I don't think that's hopeful thinking. I think that is, in fact, the case. Now, how that plays in a third world country where they're just willing to happy to have a job, I don't know. But I think that is the case. Yes, sir.
Well, how do you explain this, like a second world country like Venezuela, where, you know, American corporations were there, things grew up, the people were becoming dissatisfied, they changed their form of government, and all of a sudden the CIA is backing a coup attempt against their democratically elected leader. Now, isn't there a little fascism involved there, where the American corporations are using the American government agencies to turn things to their... I mean, how do you explain that?
Now, I don't know about the specifics there, but I will say that I generally agree, or that it is not... that there are many examples of the United States government becoming the handmaiden in some ways of U.S. business, in a way that can only be explained in that way. Not always, but there are numerous examples throughout history.
I mean, I know that when the coup attempt occurred in Haiti, which was an organic coup attempt, I mean, that wasn't an American-backed coup attempt. President Bill Clinton sent a letter, said that we are going to support any democratic leader, whether we agree with him or not, whether his name is Aristide or not. Mm-hmm. And there were lots of American businesses operating in Haiti, and... I mean, I think it's just a difference between which administration and who's running the State Department at the time, whether or not we're going to support corporations who are doing these acts in third world countries.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And also how big our stake is. I mean, Venezuela
versus
Haiti.
Yeah.
There's a natural resources differential.
Any other comments about these codes of ethics? Do you think they make a difference? So they can make a difference, certainly, by many companies have adopted them. To know whether they make a difference, we need some sort of monitoring. Many companies have subjected themselves to third-party monitoring. Yes?
My observation is that, as a comparison to this, there has been a code of ethics for accounting for a long time. And what we're finding now is that the accountants are selling out to the corporations. So what I'm pointing to you is here we don't even have a monitoring service yet. And I'm saying we got to be careful that it doesn't get to be like the CPAs because they are no better than the corporations.
Well, that's an interesting point. There are monitoring services
right.
that compare themselves to CPAs. That is, CPAs are going to monitor a company's profitability and financial statement. Others are going to monitor compliance with global norms on sustainability. There are groups that monitor whether factories use child labor, whether factories use kind of compulsory or forced labor. But you're pointing out, of course, that the monitoring effort is only as good as the individual's monitoring.
I favor having independent monitoring organizations much better than having a government do. But somehow we need to get a little more honesty in the monitors.
Let me tell you a bit about my favorite code of corporate ethics, and that is promulgated by the Organization for Economic and Cooperation and Development, the OECD. Are you familiar with that? That is a group of primarily developed countries that have signed on, including the United States, most European countries, some Asian countries now, and have formed via a convention organization that looks at international trade and other economic issues. They developed guidelines for multinational corporations. Those guidelines for multinational corporations I didn't duplicate because they go on for more pages than weight I was willing to carry in 50 copies to hold in the village. But let me say that it is much more specific than these principles, though they follow the basic organization factor of these principles. The OECD is realistic in understanding that multinational corporations in many ways are beyond the regulation of any individual country. And we can think of U.S. Corporations that have incorporated elsewhere. Certainly, multinational corporations in many ways float above individual nations' regulatory schemes. If they don't like the labor regulations in one country, they can pull out of that. We need to look for ways to get hooks into those multinational corporations. Yes?
You know, I understand the logic of saying but there's this kind of voodoo corporation thing that somehow these guys are out there in an unregulated sense. Well, all of them exist if they're an American chartered corporation.
Yeah, I mean, some go offshore. Take Tyco as an example.
Okay,
yeah.
So, but many of them have a legal basis in places, and they don't go in. But when they do go into places, they get regulated. In fact, the unregulated places are places like the United States. Right? Now, it may be corrupt, and there may be ways to escape the regulation. But in the early 19th century, states regulated corporations all over the place.
Yes, but and I would agree. But is there one jurisdiction talking about comprehensive sustainability standards that applies it to all corporations incorporated in those areas? State incorporation laws are very,
very
shallow, very iffy.
Yeah, so in the United States, there's 50 different states with 50 different kinds of corporations, right?
Right.
And we don't think of ourselves as having the problem the Pennsylvania corporations coming in and ripping off Washington State. Now, we did. We have, there used to be, you know, the rules about interstate competition and competition are different. But, in fact, we have effective regulation of what used to be called foreign corporations.
I mean, but there is a bit of that, not to get into too fine a point, but, you know, having taught at the University of Montana, you look at regulation of mining corporations.
Right.
Now, that has been federalized to a certain extent, but they incorporate where? They incorporate in Delaware, because under the Delaware,
it has
better deals. So once a corporation goes out of existence, the look-back period, separate from federal law, is only a couple of years. So they didn't incorporate in Montana because of the stricter regulations. That's
the same thing, you know, Microsoft in Europe is getting, they're getting hit with the same antitrust cases in Europe.
Sure, absolutely.
They got hit
Absolutely. And I don't mean to say that multinational corporations can escape all regulation.
Right.
But certainly, if regulation gets too strict in any country, they can pull up stakes and leave. Maybe not from the United States, because there are a sufficient number of hooks. We have the hook of the stock exchange. We have the hook of state and corporation laws. But what about Cambodia? If they don't like a clothing manufacturer or how they're regulated there, they're gone, are they not?
No, I think that's right. But there's also, I mean, think about Aramco, which is the big oil company in Saudi Arabia. Who built that? It was all Western Europeans?
Yes.
Oil companies. Who turned out? Got nationalized.
Right.
Okay. Bolivia just decided to nationalize its oil fields, partly with Chavez's blessing from Venezuela. Brazil's really upset because it turns out Brazil wrote a long-term contract to get their oil from the Western oil companies in Bolivia, who are now no longer, they don't even own their stuff anymore. They're being told. So there's a bit more, should not be characterized in terms of large multinational corporations and small, powerless, developing countries who can't do anything about these guys. They can. They do it at some cost.
Yeah. I mean, it's easier to do it in certain countries, is it?
Oh, sure.
Yeah. You know, when the oil is there and you have jurisdiction over the oil, it's a little easier than a clothing manufacturer or assembly point for VCRs and so on. I think your point's well taken. The emerging international standard that many of us would like to see, of course, is the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. It takes these global principles, Sullivan principles, and puts more flesh on them. One of the problems with respect to the Sullivan principles, the UN principles, is what do they really mean? You look at the words and they set aspirational standards, but don't tell us much on the ground about how to pay employees, about what environmental standards we ought to hold ourselves to. Let me give you a couple of examples that I find fascinating out of the OECD principles, for example. One relates to the environment. What do you think international best practices are with respect to whose environmental laws you comply with, according to the OECD? Now, you're going to have lax pollution laws in some jurisdictions. Here's what they say, that an ethical business will continue to improve corporate environmental performance by adopting technologies and operating procedures in all parts of the enterprise, that reflect standards concerning environmental performance in the best performing part of the enterprise. So the OECD adds to the debate that it's a responsibility of a corporation not only to comply with the host nation's environmental standards, wherever they're operating, but higher environmental standards, those environmental standards that apply to the most best-performing part of the enterprise. Likewise, under the OECD standards, there is substantial discussion of technology transfer. If one is operating in a developing country, one ought to license that technology where practicable upon fair terms within that country. That's something tough for a corporation to certainly do. One ought to do as much research in that country as possible. The OECD prohibits bribes in a much broader way than our Foreign Corrupt Practices Act do. So there are some emerging standards out there that are much more specific with respect to what type of wages to pay, how to comply with the environmental laws, and so on. What's the problem with these standards? They're voluntary. They're hard to monitor. They're vague. In a way, even the OECD standards are 20 pages long. How then can we go about encouraging multinational enterprises to adopt what I think are some emerging standards? You see a lot of similarities between the Global Sullivan principles, the UN principles, the OECD principles. Various trade associations have principles. Yes, sir.
I think it's a marketing issue. If enough consumers resist corporations that fail to follow these laws, the world will eventually change. Now, consumers are also investors, and so there's some type of... There are more consumers than there are investors. If enough consumers say, you didn't follow reasonable practices, I will not buy your product, that will eventually drive the market.
Well, let me ask about that. Let me ask about
Walmart,
that.
But Walmart is counters his argument. I mean, Walmart, the world's largest retailer with the worst environmental record, labor record, safety record of any corporation in existence, is still the world's number one retailer.
Are those statements true?
I don't know where those statements are true, but I'll bet with respect to Walmart.
There's enough out there on Walmart. I mean, for those of you who've been in the village, Walmart had a bomb threat somewhere back east, and they forced the employees to search the store. The employees, not the bomb squad, the people who were trained to do it, they forced the employees. I know a lot of it's anecdotal.
Yeah. Here, in my opinion, is the problem with many U.S. corporations. And I assume it applies to Walmart, but I don't know. I haven't studied it. Many of these corporations have pretty impressive codes of social responsibility. I don't know whether Walmart does or not. These codes of social responsibility, in my opinion, break down in two ways. Number one, they're on the books, but no one is enforcing them. So you have managers in other countries that know what the code is, but don't really enforce them. And the corporate home office in New Jersey or New York may or may not be interested in that. They might be interested in the profitability of the unit in that country. Secondly, and perhaps a larger concern, and I think this applies to Walmart, is that the corporate codes of ethics are not applied to suppliers. So you have this vast number of suppliers and factories supplying the Walmarts of the world, and there is not a serious attempt to apply these standards of responsibility to suppliers. So in a sense, they're subcontracting out.
Suppliers are corporations.
They're corporations.
Suppliers are corporations,
too. If we talk about corporate standards, we can't say Walmart, but they don't do this stuff to suppliers. Because we could say, well, these are suppliers, and they don't do this to their downstream retailers.
Yeah.
That's a cement.
Well, but I don't know about that. I mean, others do. Nike does. Now, if you believe their press releases and you believe what others say about them, if you buy a Nike shoe, you can be pretty sure that certain labor standards were supplied. At Augustana College, if you buy a Augustana T-shirt, or at virtually any college, there are buying associations, or at Holden Village over here, you can be pretty sure, unless the system breaks down because of buying cooperatives, that independent groups have looked at whether labor standards are applied. So to have a corporate code of ethics, to me, is not enough if, in fact, you don't encourage the supply chain also. Yes.
Perhaps to your question on catalyst for change, part of it may be global economics, that often what drives is money. And countries that are behind the curve competitively may support certain new standards because they see a competitive advantage. It's a way to compete against, for example, U.S. multinationals. So that could be attraction point, and that analogy exists in other mm-hmm. other standards globally. And mm-hmm. that may be a beginning.
Mm-hmm. Could be. Any other ways to ensure that these evolving international standards are adopted?
Well, I think some of these standards actually favor corporations over smaller organizations, particularly trademark protection, intellectual property protection.
Right.
And to a degree, this is just based on a very limited experience. I've been a few times to work in Moldova, which is in Eastern Europe, and you know, even bribery, I think, ultimately can work against a large corporation because there are these, and especially trademark protection. But if you encourage a country to a point of lawlessness where bribery is really rampant, you also have to face customs fraud or customs extortion, things like that, and just the general disorder that it creates actually makes it very difficult to do business. I know for a fact there are companies waiting to invest in Moldova because they have a very educated workforce, but they won't go in until some of that is cleaned up because it's just too disorderly.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. Bribery eventually breaks down social and governmental systems. We could talk about, there's some good aspects of bribery. What about in China? We see a lot of bribery in China, too. Is that all bad? Is it all bad to really get to know our business partners and exchange gifts to get to know our business? How do we get to know our business partners in the United States? We are attorneys to draft documents that are 100 pages long, preparing for all the contingencies. Is all gift-giving bad?
Some economies depend on it because there's not an alternative. So is it all bad? No. Should it change in places? Absolutely.
Yes.
I think what you said is really, really important because we live in a world in which companies can make contracts, in which these kind of promises are made between two companies. They're enforced. Right? And there's no wishy-washy, is this going to be monitored? Is this going to be enforced? We have a system, a third-party enforcement, in which companies agree to contracts which they know will have the force of law, and if either side breaks them, they go. And so, in fact, companies don't start with lawyers. They start on the golf course, they do deals, they work things out, and when it comes down to the nitty-gritty of how we're going to deal with this, we're going to build a $1 billion Intel chip plant, and we're going to sink $1 billion into this community, and we're going to have 50 firms involved. Boy, you better believe that everybody there is signed on the dotted line about what they have to do, which is why they can't build a $1 billion chip plant in China.
Right.
Right? Because there's absolutely no way that everybody involved can be sure. But then it gets real difficult to talk about bribing and brunches and lunches in the United States as if it meant the same thing in China.
It is interesting. One of the few areas where the United States Congress has chosen to regulate business conduct abroad is through the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, which stops bribery. With respect to regulation of fair employment practices, generally Congress doesn't purport to do that for U.S. corporations doing business abroad. Environmental, and I find it to be interesting because what is a bribe? Does bribery exist in the United States? Also, when Augustana College hires a lobbyist to help us, in fact, advocate for student aid. Is that a bribe? Well, it's not an illegal bribe, but it's a payment for something in return. Now, it's a good payment in our eyes, certainly, but the gift-giving in China, and I agree with you, I've taught in China, and it's unmanageable, the legal system to enforce contracts, intellectual property rights, and so on. They can write all the laws on the books that they want. Current time, it is impossible to afford. I'd still like to look a little bit. I want to come back to this gentleman's comment that the power of the consumer can make a difference here. Do you believe that? I think it can make a difference. Will it make a difference? Look at Nike. Nike has done a great job, but then I go out to Walmart, and I'm a little bit with you on Walmart, and You know, how many people buying clothing for the absolutely lowest price, or VCR for the lowest price, are asking about the business practices of the company? Even if they did, what would their source of information be? So there's some information asymmetry here between the corporations and the customers. It is hard to evaluate. Can individual companies make a difference? Can places like REI, that I got my new pants from, make a difference? Maybe, because it is a like-minded group of shareholders. It is a management that is committed. But I would submit to you that in many ways, customers are going to have a tough time making a difference. Now, I bought a new pair of zip-off pants from REI for this trip, $50. I thought, I'm not spending $50 for a pair of pants, but I did anyway, because I knew I'd get a rebate back from them. But I can afford to spend $50 for my zip-off pants and be sure that the standards for manufacturing these pants, wherever they were, I think it's Vietnam it says inside, were ethical. Can someone making $7 an hour afford to do that? So, you know, there are some concerns there, I think. Yes?
I do think, although my hometown has been gutted by Walmart, and I'm just visiting my parents there, so please don't misunderstand that I'm in favor of their practices, but I think that Walmart's recent move toward creating a whole mechanism to try to manage its image as, in terms of ecology, in terms of how it treats its people, is a sign that there is power in public opinion about these kinds of things. Now, is it going to make Walmart behave well? I'm pretty cynical about that. But just the fact that they're concerned about it makes a difference. And there is actually the fact that there are people working for Walmart in China who are checking on some of the practices of some of their suppliers there. Is it what we would all like? It's not. But ironically, Walmart is doing some of what we're talking about in China. And also ironically, I spent 4 months in China this last semester, fall semester. It's getting harder for some of the corporations in China to fill the low-level jobs. And so now they are shipping work out to Vietnam and to Thailand and some other companies, because in the area that I was just outside of Shanghai, they can't get people to do those sweatshop jobs anymore. There are people coming in from the provinces, but not in at the rate that there were. And of course, the Chinese government is working hard to try to keep people at home.
Yeah, they won't let them move.
Yeah.
Well, consumers can do some things then. Walmart, what if Walmart in fact was more aggressive about this? Walmart, in fact, had a supply chain code of ethics with very specific standards, perhaps involving emerging international ethics, had plants audited by an independent third party. Would that make any difference? That certainly is one way of forcing or creating incentives for global corporate responsibility. Now, will Walmart do that, in fact? To what extent does that interfere with profitability and their promise to be the lowest cost customer? But many companies do that, and many companies do that, I think, effectively.
Yeah, a couple weeks ago, I read The Economist magazine, and so there was a special issue. They have special issues every year. One on logistics. So Walmart was really an example of how do you do this. In FedEx and UPS, how do you buy things? So, I mean, the reason Walmart has done so well is that it sells things more cheaply. And it doesn't sell things more cheaply because it pays its labor dramatically less than other places pay. Because, in fact, they all pay the minimum wage for most of these jobs, and entry-level jobs. Because Walmart manages its supply chain much more effectively than any other place. They were big in computers. They were big in central warehousing and doing all that kind of stuff. And so part of the point of that article is that Walmart did change the supply chain. You know, these are constantly changing kinds of things. And Walmart won't, you know, Walmart probably won't be Walmart in 50 years because somebody else will figure out the next thing that works better.
Well, Walmart farmed out their delivery system. They don't do it. And not farmed it out to either FedEx or UPS.
They have parts of it, right?
And they do it.
they figured.
They did that because it was a lot more effective. They keep track of it.
Right. So but that's where this business about can Walmart change it? Yeah, any business can change it. If in fact that's what it decides to do.
So well, Walmart could change the world, right? And maybe they have. Yeah, they have changed the world in many ways. But imagine if they would develop supply chain codes. They have some now. But the supply chain codes that might be more rigorous, that with a little more external monitoring, I don't know how much external monitoring they do, but imagine the power that's possible there. Yes?
Just the other side of the coin. If Walmart were to offer $7 jeans and $10 source guaranteed jeans, what do you think the proportion of sales would be? By source guaranteed, you know, all of these policies follow.
I think the source guaranteed jeans would not sell.
That's
well.
Correct.
Yeah, so that would be my view.
My point is that there's a large part of the economy that wants the lowest price no matter what, no matter who it hurts.
Yeah. And, you know, I just caution us. You know, we can be critical of that part of the economy, but for those of us who are middle class and above, it's great. Yeah, we go out and buy the more expensive jeans for those making minimum wage. That's a lot to ask. Yes?
I don't want to quibble, but I really think it, I mean, I really do hear your point about people who are making $7 an hour. I live in a very, very affluent community, and people are excited about buying discount stuff. I really do think a part of it is in America, there's a moral value of a bargain or something cheap. I have a lot of patients who are very wealthy people that are gloating over saving, you know, 59 cents at the grocery store. It's not, to me, it's sad,
right?
Because I actually,
lots of people got to
be, I don't shop at those places because it's not worth it to me.
Yeah.
I would rather have less things and better quality thing. But I think that part of it is to actually getting at that value.
Well, I think you're right. I'm a little skeptical on the ability of consumers to make a wholesale difference in forcing corporate responsibility. Because many consumers will buy that product, which is the cheapest, that has some quality. B, it's a lot to ask consumers. I mean, how do you know? How do you know what you're buying? Are there other ways? I mean, we've talked about supply chains, a Walmart, a Nike, can make a real difference there. Are there other ways to force or create incentives for these factories to operate responsibly? What about shareholders' resolutions? You all know what shareholders' resolutions are. Certainly the ELCA offers a number of shareholders' resolutions per year. We might just take a quick look at, in the materials, I have listed the ELCA shareholders' resolutions. Be under unit number 6. We'll talk about these a little bit more on Thursday. The ELCA, through, I presume, pension plan, other investments, own stocks. These are the shareholders' resolutions that they have submitted this year. There are hundreds of shareholders' resolutions submitted each year. Now, a couple of these go to issues of international norms. You look at Burlington Resources, the sustainability report. The ELCA would like Burlington Northern to issue sustainability reports. Are their operations sustainable based on Global Reporting Initiative sustainability reporting outlines, a third party that is going to, in fact, monitor that. Can individual shareholders and churches make any difference? Do these shareholders' resolutions do any good? They are always, or almost always, voted down.
Well, they may not do good, but that doesn't mean you don't try.
Okay.
Our church did one with Intel and got the no-no back laughing, so we got rid of all their stock.
Perhaps one of the impacts of shareholder resolution can be one of PR, and the market doesn't always respond to exact economic or business pressure, but rather herd mentality.
Mm-hmm.
So it could be a catalyst for negative PR, that would become a concern.
Well, look at what happened to these resolutions. One was knocked out by the Securities Exchange Commission. A few were pending, but most are withdrawn due to constructive dialogue. And if you look at the Interfaith Center for Corporate Responsibility website, which kind of gathers the information on these shareholders' resolutions, many, many are withdrawn because of constructive dialogue with the company. So I think shareholders' resolutions can make a difference. Shareholders' resolutions, when coupled with a press strategy, can make a difference. And I would guess that the ALCA has made a difference. They're bright people. I don't think they're going to withdraw these because of hollow promises from the corporations. Many shareholders' resolutions go to issues of international corporate responsibility and compliance with this or that emerging international standard. I think there are other ways of encouraging social responsibility. The best way, of course, is the enlightened self-interest of the company. These international corporations are managed by people, in many cases, like the people at Holden Village. Bright people with a social conscience. Certainly the church can do its part in helping us think through those obligations. Corporate CEOs that I've known, and I've known a number, generally want to do the right thing. Well, they're trying to figure out how to do the right thing given the pressures of the market and so on. But I don't think the system is hopeless. I think as we enlighten ourselves, whether it be through shareholders' resolutions, as consumers, for those of us lucky to be in management position, time after time, there are examples of people making a difference. The ELCA, managers of Nike, managers of Levi Strauss. Intel has done some pretty good things, too. So it is not hopeless in my mind. Any closing comments or observations before we close? Yes.
I think one of the things, though, that you need to be careful about, and again, this time that I spent in China was very useful for me, because we tend to come at these things as though we presume we know what the best thing is for this second or third world nation. And the values, the lifestyles, you talk about the gift-giving in China. Yes, it is different. There are some things that horrify me about Chinese culture, and there are some other things of which I am just in awe. And so I think there is also a certain amount of humility that needs to be undertaken. Now, trying to engender humility in multinational corporations may be harder than social.
Yeah, but I think that is an outstanding point and a point not to be lost, particularly with our notions of corporate responsibility. They do not travel well, many have observed, because the culture is so different. There is so much to be learned from other cultures. If you believe the cynics, however, and the global economy is a race to the bottom, who can regulate less, we have cause to be concerned. Another closing observation?
There's more days.
Yeah, indeed. Next time we're going to get down to the nitty-gritty, and we're going to ask you to put your hat on, assuming that you are managing a factory abroad in a developing country for a United States business, United States corporation. And we're going to ask you to think about how you would conduct yourself there and what standards you would hold yourself to. Then on Wednesday, we're going to move to the corporate boardroom, and we are going to talk about drafting corporate codes of responsibility for U.S. Corporations that make a difference, that are more than window dressing. And again, on our final day together, which will be Thursday, I want to look at the ELCA resolutions, get behind these resolutions, and ask how we can use shareholders' resolutions to make a difference. Thank you so much.